Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a terrific show for you today. We have joining us one of the most storied and accomplished foreign correspondents in recent U.S. journalism history. We're going to be talking about U.S. foreign policy, specifically the United States and Iran. Our guest will be Stephen Kinzer, author and former New York Times foreign correspondent. But first, before we go to today's show, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Motion Picture Association of America has admitted using faulty data to make its case to Congress that colleges and universities should filter their networks for copyright violations. The MPAA had claimed that 44% of industry losses came from college students downloading movies illegally. But last week, the lobbying arm for the largest movie studios admitted that its figures were wrong and that campus activities only amounted to 15% of losses. Legislation backed by the MPAA, the Prioritizing Resources and Organization for Intellectual Property Act of 2007, is now working its way through the House of Representatives. Gigi Sohn, president and co-founder of Public Knowledge, has been an outspoken critic of the MPAA's tactics from the beginning.
Congress has been asking the Motion Picture Association for at least 18 months now for the data and methodology behind this study, and they've refused to give it to them. So this whole study has all been thrown into question.
In fact, Sohn thinks that the 15% figure is too high.
A study done by higher education folks show that a full 80% of college students live off campus. So the vast majority of the time, they're using their home networks. They're not using college networks. So that even calls a 15% number into question.
Sohn says that colleges already police their networks for copyright violations and bandwidth hogging. But there's a difference between policing for terms of service violations and filtering the network.
First of all, filtering technology costs the university an awful lot of money. Right now, with copyright enforcement, most of the cost of enforcement is borne by the copyright holder, as it should be. Second, copyright filtering catches a lot of dolphin in the tuna net. So there are a lot of false positives. There's no filter now that can determine whether somebody is using a copyrighted work for legitimate commentary, parody, and other legitimate uses for legitimate fair creative uses, and one that is not. And that's really critical. And when you're a university, the last thing you want to do is stop the free flow of knowledge. Okay? Is stop the free flow of information because some huge corporate entity is forcing you to use a network filter.
For more information on copyright reform, go to publicknowledge.org.
Newspaper giant Gannett is looking to get into the student newspaper business. In Fort Collins, Colorado, where the nation's largest newspaper company also owns the Coloradoan, the local daily, Gannett has expressed interest in partnering with the Colorado State University newspaper, the Collegian. So far, the talks between Gannett and university administrators have been shrouded in secrecy. No staff or advisor from the paper was invited to participate. But any deal would be the first time a corporate news company took over a nonprofit college newspaper from a public institution. Gannett does own student newspapers in Florida, but they were privately owned at the time of their sale. Frank Lomonti, executive director of the Student Press Law Center, says the move could have been motivated by a controversy last September when the editor-in-chief of the Collegian printed a foreword editorial aimed at President Bush, which can't be quoted on the public airwaves.
Our concern would be, is the university timing the sale of the newspaper in any way as a retaliatory measure or as a measure to deprive the student editors of the First Amendment protections they would otherwise have? The First Amendment only protects against censorship by state actors. Obviously, if the newspaper were sold to a private enterprise, they would then lose their status as a public forum protected by First Amendment protections.
CSU journalism professor Donna Rauner agrees with Lomonti that the deal could be motivated by the September incident. And she's also concerned about covering the university through a single corporate lens.
That is always better for a democracy, to have many voices, not one voice, a corporate voice, particularly when you're talking about the voice of students in a public setting and their varied, sometimes dissenting voices. And it's a university community. We need a student voice in reporting that community, not just a corporate voice in reporting that community.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 3, 2008. Here in the heart of winter, as we make our way forward into the spring. Another place we're making our way forward is with the country of Iran, which is in the sights of the U.S. government and the subject of great concern among U.S. policymakers. And we're very fortunate today to have as our guest one of the real experts on U.S.-Iranian relations and U.S.-Iranian politics, and someone who's written widely on U.S. foreign policy, one of the great journalists of the past few decades. Stephen Kinzer has covered more than 50 countries and five continents in his career with the New York Times. He's the author of numerous books, including most recently Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. And this is a one-hour interview we will be having with Stephen Kinzer indeed. And I'm delighted now to welcome Steve Kinzer to Media Matters. Mr. Kinzer?
Wonderful to be with you.
Pleasure to have you back again. I remember fondly our program with you a couple of years ago upon the publication of Overthrow. You were going to be coming to Champaign-Urbana in 2 weeks to be speaking on the subject of Iran, which about which you wrote a book 4 years ago, it was released 5 years ago now, heavens, All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. What are you going to be talking about when you come to town?
There's a growing sense in the United States that the crisis with Iran that the United States has confronted over recent months and years is not yet over. I have a fear that since we recently had the release of this national intelligence estimate suggesting that Iran was not, in fact, working towards producing a nuclear weapon, and that there doesn't seem to be any public outcry for an attack on Iran, and that the United States is so bogged down in Iraq that it couldn't possibly launch another attack, that therefore the danger of the United States attacking Iran has more or less evaporated. I fear that the more people who believe this, and the more Americans come to assume that this is true, the more likely such an attack will be. I think that the prospect of an American attack on Iran still is very real. I think it would be a terrible thing, not just for Iran, but also for the United States. So I'll be coming to Champaign, in addition to a number of other American cities during February and March, to try to raise this issue, to make sure that Americans don't forget about the threats that are coming from Washington against Iran, and to try to assure that we don't wake up some morning to the news that American cruise missiles are raining down on Iran and another war has erupted there.
Now, since you raised the issue of the national intelligence estimate, I saw that in the most recent edition of The Economist magazine, the cover of it is on Iran and basically says that the national intelligence estimate was put forward by disgruntled intelligence people in the U.S. who were upset about how the Bush administration had misused and doctored intelligence figures for Iraq and put that out to make sure that would not happen again. But The Economist argues that, in fact, Iran still is seriously putting together nuclear weaponry.
I think the arguments that were made in that Economist piece, which I just read today myself, are the kinds of arguments that are being made in the White House itself. I fear that at some point, President Bush is going to think to himself, or some of the people around President Bush are going to say to him, something like this. We had to face the attacks of September 11th because wimpy Clinton did not take care of the threat as it was growing and waited for it to materialize in a catastrophe. Let's not do the same thing with Iran. Let's be real men. Let's stand up and do what we know has to be done. The next president won't be able to do it for political reasons. We're on our way out of office. We don't want to stand by and watch the threat grow. So let's go take care of it. I fear that this logic is going to take hold in Washington, and that we're going to have some kind of a surprise between now and January 20th, which will have terrible long-term effects for both Iran and the United States.
Now, I have to confess, Mr. Kinzer, I'm not an expert at military matters, but I do know this much. We've had the darndest time. The United States forces have had the darndest time in Afghanistan, and especially Iraq. Iran is a wealthier, much larger nation than either of those, with a much larger military and much larger population. And we're stretched thin. The United States is stretched thin. How exactly does the United States possibly pull off a successful military campaign, even if you were a proponent of such an invasion?
I think the way it would be done would probably be without a large number of ground troops. You're absolutely right that unless we send the Boy Scouts, we don't have any troops, certainly not enough of them, to launch a ground invasion of Iran. Nonetheless, a lot of targeting has gone on for Iran. There have been a lot of exercises in the Pentagon. And I think if there were an attack, it probably would be in a series of missile attacks that would be aimed at Iranian government sources and at places where we suspect that there could be nuclear research going on. So I would say a kind of a massive bombing campaign against Iran, followed by a kind of a hoped-for domestic uprising or some kind of political change would be the dream strategy. I think we've developed in the White House this fantasy that if we would bomb Iran, then Iranians would really love us. They would be very grateful to us.
That was such a big success in Vietnam.
It would be pro-American.
Yeah, that was such a big success in Vietnam.
Well, you know, you started out your question by saying I'm not an expert on that part of the world or on military matters, but we have a president who I think is not really an expert on that part of the world. We learned not so long ago that before he launched the war in Iraq, he didn't know the difference between Sunnis and Shiites. Nonetheless, the difference between him and you, besides your jobs, is that people like us might recognize that not being super experts, we shouldn't be making these kinds of decisions. You don't want to make a decision that's this profound on the basis of emotion and utopian hopes. But that exactly is the basis on which many decisions in Washington are being made these days, and I think that's where the danger lies.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Stephen Kinzer, author, former New York Times foreign correspondent, storied and award-winning, author of the book Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, also the book on the Middle East, All the Shah's Men, an American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. And I hope that we will be talking about that later in the program. If folks would like to call in with a question or comment for Stephen Kinzer, the phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mr. Kinzer, I desperately want to go into the history here, which you've written about so carefully, and also some of the political implications for the region outside of Iran and what's going on in the surrounding countries. But I wanted to just finish up this line of what we've been talking about for the first few minutes of the show. And explain to me also, if you would, what exactly is the motivation for overthrowing the Iranian government, if in fact it isn't really a threat to bomb us any more than Iraq was. It isn't a threat to take out cities and a military attack upon the United States. What exactly moves us then to take what is, by all accounts, a highly risky venture?
This is a very good question, and I would put it in a larger context. The United States maintains relations with many odious regimes. And we negotiate with regimes that are based on principles directly opposed to the principles that we as Americans embrace. Yet, we have never been able to negotiate with Iran. We have never reached out a hand of friendship or offers of compromise with Iran. What is it about Iran? Why is it that we can reach out to nations so hostile and so different But we can't reach out to Iran. This is a question I think many Iranian scholars and others have asked themselves over the years. I believe that the answer is at least as much psychological as it is political. The American foreign policy establishment, if you want to call it that, certainly the group that's in power in Washington now, has never forgiven the religious regime in Iran for its sins or its crimes against the United States. We see that regime as the regime that overthrew our Shah, who had a regime in Iran that was very pro-American. Then it took our diplomats hostage for more than a year in a crisis that had a profound, humiliating effect on the United States. In the years since then, Iranian leaders have worked intensely and sometimes quite violently to undermine American and Western interests all over the world. So there's a sense in the United States that this regime in Iran has hit us several times and has been successful, has beaten us, and we need to even the playing field, so to speak. We need to hit them back before we would be willing to sit down with them at the table. We cannot forgive what they have done in the past. So unless the United States finds a way to leap over this psychological hurdle and begin to consider coolly the possible mutual benefits of a peaceful relationship with Iran, I see this hostility continuing.
I had the privilege of visiting Iran, to date myself, over 3 decades ago, and was struck in comparison to Turkey and Afghanistan with what a modern country it was at the time. And I don't know if most Americans are really familiar with its history prior to 1979, prior to the religious government coming into place. You've written about this a lot, and I think it'd be good for our listeners to get a sense of what the history of Iran was coming out of the Second World War and why it has played such a central role, not just in Iran itself, but in the entire region in sort of defining the U.S. role.
Let me point out just 2 very important aspects of Iranian history. The first has to do with its deep history. Many of the countries in the Middle East are essentially fake countries. They were just drawn on maps by British statesmen sitting in men's clubs in Pall Mall. There's no such thing as a Saudi Arabian tradition or a Jordanian heritage. These countries are just modern creations. Iran is exactly the opposite. Iran is one of the world's oldest civilizations. It has existed more or less within the same boundaries and with more or less the same language for thousands of years, and has produced not just great conquerors and emperors like Xerxes and Cyrus and Darius, but also great poets, great scientists, at a time when Europeans were living in caves and dressing in animal skins. Iran had one of the most cultured societies in the world. So Iranians are very, very conscious of their national heritage, and even more than most other peoples in the world, very sensitive to being dismissed and hectored and treated as a low-rate people by outside powers. Now, bringing up to the more modern age, during the 18th and 19th centuries and into the first half of the 20th century, foreign powers were very dominant in Iran. Iran was governed by weak and corrupt kings and almost ceased to exist as a nation. But finally, in the period after World War II, when the winds of nationalism and anti-colonialism were blowing through the developing world, they had a profound impact in Iran. In Iran, nationalism in the period after World War II came to mean one thing. The Iranian oil industry was controlled 100% by one single foreign company that was owned mainly by the British government. So it meant that although Iran is sitting on an ocean of oil, none of the benefits from that oil came to Iran. They were all sent off to abroad. And it was the desire to retake control of Iran's oil and to use the benefits of selling oil to improve the lives of Iranians that propelled to power in the early 1950s the most remarkable modern leader in Iranian history. That was Mohammad Mossadegh. So Mossadegh has been somewhat forgotten by history, I would say, by now. But at the time, he was a towering figure. He was Time Magazine's Man of the Year for 1951. He was chosen over Douglas MacArthur, Winston Churchill, and Dwight Eisenhower. And that was a good choice because he really was the most important figure in the world at that time. And the reason was that he was leading this epic challenge against the West. He wanted to take back control of Iranian oil and use the profits from that oil industry to benefit Iran. That desire set off alarm bells in the West. And ultimately, in 1953, led the CIA to organize a coup in which Mossadegh was overthrown. So we overthrew a democracy in Iran, the only democracy that country has ever known, and imposed instead the Shah, who ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. His repression led to the explosion of the late 1970s. What we call the Islamic Revolution. That revolution brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American clerics. But yet this religious regime in power in Iran today probably would never have come to power. And this nuclear crisis we are now facing with Iran probably would never have emerged if we had allowed Iranian democracy to continue to flourish. In fact, we might have had a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East all these 50 years. And I can hardly wrap my mind around how different the Middle East and the world might be if that had happened.
Stephen Kinzer, what is the relationship of Iran's theocrats and Islamicists with al-Qaeda?
If there's any government or country in the world that hates al-Qaeda even more than the United States and Americans, it's definitely Iran. Al-Qaeda springs from radical Sunni theology. Iran is the heart of Shiite Islam. So the Shiites and the Sunnis are very different groups, and the threat of radical Sunni movements like al-Qaeda and the Taliban is one that Iran saw even before the United States saw it. So there is bitter enmity between Iran on the one hand and these radical Sunni movements like Taliban and al-Qaeda on the other hand. Just to give one example, as soon as the Taliban took over in Afghanistan, most countries withdrew all their diplomats from Afghanistan. Iran, however, maintained a consulate in northern Afghanistan. And as soon as the Taliban captured the town where that consulate was located, Taliban soldiers, as their first target, stormed the Iranian embassy and killed all the Iranian diplomats there. So the hostility between Iran and these radical Sunni movements like Taliban and al-Qaeda is very intense.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Stephen Kinzer, who you've just been listening to, now teaching journalism and politics at Northwestern University, former correspondent of the New York Times, who worked for decades in more than 50 countries on five continents, author of numerous books, including most recently Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. It's an honor to have him on the program with us today. If you have questions or comments for Mr. Kinzer, the telephone number here, 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about Iran and the Middle East, but I think all of foreign policy
Hello.
Is fair game for Mr. Kinzer.
Anybody there?
Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Elburn, you're on the air. Yes, Elburn, are you there? Okay, I think we have lost Elburn. Ah, indeed we have. Mr. Kinzer.
I'm here.
We will hopefully get our caller back. I think they grew impatient with me for not getting to them, and I apologize for that. Please do call back, caller. We will attempt to get you back on the air. You've talked about how distinct Iran is and the fact that it, in fact, has hostile relations with the Taliban and al-Qaeda. What is the nature of the relationship of Iran to Israel, and is it a different type of relationship than Israel has with other countries in the region?
The old regime, that is the Shah's regime in Iran, was very pro-Israel. There was a strong relationship between Israel and Iran. the current regime, led most publicly by President Ahmadinejad, although he's certainly not the most important figure in the country, has been just the opposite, very hostile and openly threatening toward Israel. If you put yourself in the position of Iran, you see that on one border you have a country occupied by the United States, that's Afghanistan. On the other border, you have another country occupied by the United States, that's Iraq. Iran has two great enemies in the world. Their great regional enemy is Israel, and their great world enemy is the United States. Both of those countries are nuclear armed. Therefore, Iranians, I think, feel that they have their own right to a nuclear program, and I think they see the threat from Israel as one reason why they need to develop it. In the long run, this competition is deeply destabilizing for that whole region. I believe that there is a an undercurrent in Iran, including in Iranian politics, that believes that actually Israel and Iran could have the basis for some relationship. And what would that basis be? Israel is premised on hostility toward Arabs. The Iranians, the Persians before them, have never gotten along with the Arabs either. Iran and Israel ultimately could have, in the long term, some profound security interests in common. They would need to get over some huge problems that have been erected in part by the Iranian regime. Nonetheless, to place Iran, along with Arab countries, as implacably hostile to Israel forever, I think would be a mistake.
Over the course of the past two decades or so, a lot of statistics have come out and research has shown that the amount of resources U.S. news media are devoting to foreign coverage, foreign correspondents, foreign offices, has declined, and correspondingly, the amount of actual square inches, column inches, time in newscast to foreign issues has declined as well, in fact, quite considerably. Have you seen this in your experience, and does this have any effect on how Americans perceive the world?
I've absolutely seen this, and I think it's one of the most disturbing developments we've seen in the news business over these last couple of decades. We're now in a position where very few Americans really have the information they would need to answer the question, would it be a good idea to bomb Iran, or would it be a bad idea? However, every American has more than enough information to answer the question, is Britney Spears a good mom, or is she a bad mom? So we've gotten this great disconnect. And, you know, I think it's especially lamentable because of the position of the United States in the world. If people in Paraguay don't know anything about Iran, that probably is unfortunate, but it's not going to affect the course of world events, and it's not going to make any difference to Iran. But if people in the United States don't know anything about Iran, that's much more serious, because in the U.S., we have this frightening combination of, on the one hand, the huge power that we wield over the whole world, and on the other hand, our utter ignorance about what's going on in most foreign countries. That disconnect allows us to take steps without real public debate in ways that can not only be devastating for the target countries, but can also, in the long run, greatly undermine the security of the United States.
Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We have a full bank of callers. I promise we'll get to all of you. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Elburn, do we have you this time?
I think you do.
Great. You're on the air with Stephen Kinzer.
I was wondering why the United States is acting as a stooge for Saudi Arabia. I mean, Iran and Iraq were both the most westernized in the Middle East, and we completely destroyed Iraq and brought in fundamentalists, and now we're going to do that again in under the Saudi theology. And here we've got the president going and dancing and holding hands with the ruler of the government that sent 20 of 19 of the 20 hijackers. We've got Halliburton, the vice president's company, moving to Dubai, and a Bin Laden built complex, funneling money that they don't pay taxes on, that they have no bid contracts on, into Bin Laden family, and all of this to make a solidly fundamentalist Middle East.
All right. Well, thank you very much, caller. Stephen Kinzer, any comments?
Quite an interesting observation. It certainly was bizarre to see President Bush not only holding hands with and dancing with the Saudi leader, but also essentially begging him not to raise oil prices. Why is it that the United States has become involved in this intimate relationship with a country where women are not allowed to drive, and women who are raped are sentenced to be lashed as punishment for being raped? I think there are two reasons. First of all, and this is really an issue that can never be overlooked when big powers deal with the Middle East, it's about oil. Saudi Arabia has a huge amount of oil. The United States is completely reliant on imported oil, and the Saudis are willing to supply it to us on their own terms, but with virtually unlimited supply. So the idea that we've got a reliable source of oil over there, since we so desperately need this injection of petroleum, I think is a fundamental part of the reason. I think there also is a second reason. The United States, certainly ever since World War II, has always wanted to have one country in the Muslim Middle East from which we could project power throughout that entire region. Now, all during the late 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s, that country was Iran. After the pro-American government in Iran fell, we shifted our focus to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia became essentially the number one base for American power projection in the Middle East. Actually, I think part of the reason we invaded Iraq was the sense that our base in Saudi Arabia was looking a little bit shaky. As you remember, Osama bin Laden's first statement about why he was so angry at the United States was that the U.S. was maintaining bases in the land where Islam's holiest sites are located, that is, Saudi Arabia. We thought, I think, that we could take some of the pressure off Saudi Arabia, because many other people in the Arab world feel the same way, by taking over Iraq, and then thereby being able to withdraw our troops from Saudi Arabia and build ourselves a new power projection platform in Iraq. So I think these two reasons, Saudi Arabia's willingness to supply us with large amounts of oil and its willingness to be a base for American military power projection in the Middle East, are the reasons why we've become entangled in this most dubious relationship.
Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, you're listening to Media Matters here in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air. Line 1, you're here. Okay, it looks like line 1 was captured by that last answer. So let's go ahead, if we can, now to line 3. Champaign County, you're on the air with Stephen Kinzer.
Hi. Vis-a-vis Iranian Israeli relations, I noticed that your tour includes, well, there's a website that coordinates it, and the Trita Parsi, who has the book on the history of Iran-Israel relations, is also on your tour. And I can't remember the name of your website. I'm sure you guys have it. But for people who are listening on podcasts, et cetera, I wanted to ask about this caller who was talking about why we seem to prefer fundamentalist regimes to secular regimes. I don't think it's sort of the nationalism of the secular regimes that seems to be the offensive thing. There's a guy named Robert Dreyfuss who has a book out called The Devil's Game, where he says so many times the U.S. has opted for a non-leftist or non-nationalist regime and prefer to support a religious fundamentalism, just because of the lack, they would seem to be more pliant for Western investment, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there are people like Gary Sick and Bonnie Sauter who think that the secular portion of the Iranian revolution was undermined by the U.S. Connivance, not just the Iran-Contra deals, which certainly helped solidify the regime in the early 80s, only a few years after the revolution. I wanted you to address that, if you could. The other thing, and I'll hang up on this, is David Barsamian was on some time ago. He has a new book out about Iran, and I was asking about this argument that's going around about how we're already at a war with Iran in a way. He named six different regions and six different sorts of ethnic groups or dissidents or something that the U.S. is aiding. Now, the most blatant, it seems to me, is the Kurdistan, PJAK, not to be confused with PKK, that the U.S., through a variety of means, is aiding aiding their destabilization and their attacks across the border. He names the Baluchistans, I forget how to say them, but in a sense, it's an undiscussed issue that we are already using mechanisms, covert mechanisms, to fight with Iran, and it makes the idea of an outright attack seems, if we don't get satisfaction by the means that we're using now, that they might indeed do something like this before the end of the term. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Stephen Kinzer, as you answered, let me add one more bit to that, if I can. If you could work in your assessment of how the presidential candidates this year on both the Republican and Democratic side have done in sort of talking about Iran policy in their speeches and in their literature.
Okay, that's quite a mouthful. Let me first mention, since the caller did, what this website is to which he's referring. Those people that are interested in seeing where they can go out and hear public discussions in their own cities across America on this issue could check the website. Its address is www.follyofattackingiran.org. Now, let me start with the first point that the caller made after mentioning the website, and that was American alliance with fundamentalist regimes in places like Saudi Arabia. I would put that in a larger context, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. The United States has often preferred to deal with dictatorships than to deal with democracies. The reason is very simple. A dictator can impose his will. There are no strikes or student protests or newspaper editorials to stand in the way of the government doing what it wants. So you have a country like Saudi Arabia where you only need to negotiate with one person, essentially, or one small group. That makes it a lot easier to deal with than a country that's a true democracy. This disconnect has led us in many parts of the world to overthrow fundamentally democratic regimes that embrace basic American principles and replace them with tyrannies led by people who despise everything the United States stands for. Regarding the proxy war sort of being waged by smaller rebel insurgents against the Iranian government, this is a somewhat undiscussed but very important fact. Let me just make one point to illustrate this, and it deals with the Kurdish revolutionary group to which the caller referred. Now, based in northern Iraq, where we have this Kurdish regime, there are two militant Kurdish revolutionary groups. One of them, the PKK, is aimed at Turkey. They want to destabilize Turkey and force the Turkish government either to fall or to grant it sweeping concessions. They are using terrorist tactics. They're raiding into Turkey and killing policemen and blowing up school buses and doing the kinds of things that terrorists do. Now, there's another group. In fact, this group actually even shares bases and intelligence and weaponry with the PKK. That's the PJAK to which the caller referred. Now, this group is doing the exact same thing the PKK is doing, using the exact same tactics, but instead of using them against Turkey, which is an American ally, it's using them against Iran, which we consider to be our enemy. So what has been the result of this? These two groups, which are doing the exact same thing, just in different directions, are treated completely differently by the United States. We have listed the PKK as a terrorist organization officially. And not only are we not listing the PJAK as a terrorist group, we are actually actively supporting and aiding and encouraging it. So this shows the extent to which the word terrorist has effectively lost all of its meaning. We don't go around the world looking for groups that are terrorist and then put them on our list of terrorist groups. We look around the world for groups that we don't like, groups that are attacking governments that are pro-American, and then we list them as terrorists, whereas groups that use those same tactics but use them against governments we don't like are characterized not only as freedom fighters, but are eligible for American aid. Now, you asked about presidential candidates. I sense that the Iran issue and maybe even foreign policy in general is receding a little bit in the presidential campaign. What I do think is interesting is that not so much the issue of Iran, but the issue of whether the United States should negotiate with regimes we don't like has become an important debating point. I was very pleased to see Senator Obama saying that countries that we don't like and countries that don't like us are exactly the countries we should be negotiating with. I agree with this. I don't think countries should have to behave in a good way or have to give the United States something in order to qualify for negotiations. You don't have to negotiate with your friends. They're already on your side. The people any country needs to negotiate with are its enemies, the ones it hates the most and the ones that hate it the most, the people that are killing our children. Those are the ones we need to talk to. It's the hostile enemies that are crying out for some kind of negotiated solution. But yet, we've fallen into this mindset in the United States that it's kind of wimpy or conciliatory or weak to negotiate. Actually, the United States, at this moment in history, is on top of the world. It's countries that are on the bottom, just like it's people that are on the bottom, who like upheaval and turmoil and revolution and instability. They're on the bottom anyway. So if things get all changed around, all they can do is wind up as bad as they were, and maybe they can get better. But when you're at the top, like the United States is, stability is the great asset. Instead of trying to pursue policies like diplomatic contacts that in the long run can produce stability, we are involved in this kind of Trotskyite policy where we want permanent revolution and permanent upheaval rather than calming diplomatic contacts. And I think that is an issue that, at least to a certain degree, is being raised in the presidential campaign.
Stephen Kinzer, our guest today on Media Matters. Stephen Kinzer, longtime foreign correspondent for The New York Times, who spent a lot of time in Latin America and Nicaragua and has written at some length about Central America and Latin America. I'd like to ask you just briefly to follow up on sort of the analogy you're making and talk about the U.S. relations today with the government of Venezuela, which on one hand seems like a fairly democratic rule of law sort of place, yet has been singled out for sort of harsh judgment in the news media by politicians of both parties in a way that, you know, is unusual for a Latin American country today.
Interestingly enough, though, I'd point out something different that I often hear from friends in Latin America, not just in Venezuela, but in other countries that have kind of left-oriented governments, whether it's Ecuador or Bolivia or Nicaragua or Brazil or Chile. They say, and I haven't heard this from anywhere else in the world, that actually the Iraq War might have been a good thing. Because from their perspective, they feel that they would never have been able to get away with these kind of social democratic, left-oriented reforms if the United States had not been so completely consumed with what's happening in the Middle East. It's true that the United States has been very vocal in its opposition to President Chavez in Venezuela. And in fact, at one point, we even tried and briefly succeeded in overthrowing him. Nonetheless, I think that we probably would be much more intently focused on what he and these other left-leaning governments in Latin America were doing if we were not so obsessed with what's happening in the Middle East. I think also there is a strange sense, and this goes beyond our policy toward Latin America, it's our policies towards the whole world, that when a government comes to power that is nationalist and democratic in any country, it will automatically be pro-American. There's this odd sense that the only people in the world who could be anti-American would be either those who are very uninformed and ignorant, or else those that are malicious and evil. The idea that a nationalist in another country, that a Democrat in another country, would want to place the interests of his or her own country ahead of the interests of the United States is something we can't quite conceive of. So we have this odd feeling that any government that is opposed to fundamental United States foreign policies must be brutal and repressive and couldn't possibly represent the will of its own people. This has led us into confrontations with governments that actually are much more like our own government and our own society than some of the countries we're so friendly with.
Our guest today in Media Matters, speaking to us live, is Stephen Kinzer, who teaches journalism and politics at Northwestern University. Many years, a storied foreign correspondent for the New York Times, author of numerous books, including Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. Stephen Kinzer will be in Champaign-Urbana on Sunday, February 17th, 2 weeks from today, speaking at 3 p.m. at the University YMCA, talking about Iran in particular. And I urge folks to attend that if possible. You know, one of the things in the field of journalism, Stephen Kinzer, that's taken place at a ramped up speed over the past 5 years since the invasion of Iraq is sort of an internal questioning among professional journalists and working journalists if following the standards of professional journalism sometimes puts them in the position of suspending critical judgment and simply repeating claims of the government without fully interrogating them. In fact, that it discourages too strong a criticism. The argument would be that someone like yourself, you couldn't have spoken out like this if you were working still as a reporter, but now that you're away from that, you have a liberty to, frankly, tell the truth.
I was able to break out of the prison of objectivity by leaving the New York Times after more than 20 years. There is some truth to what you say. Here's the way I would frame it. The government of the U.S. is not able to tell journalists what to write. It does, however, have great power to tell journalists what to write about. Anytime the White House and the president begin harping on a theme, journalists naturally have to cover that. We have to write about that. That gives the president and the White House great ability to shape the terms of debate. Issues that are not considered important in Washington, issues that the president never brings up, are thought of as insignificant and not worth substantial coverage, whereas those issues that the president is constantly speaking about demand huge coverage. So what this does is it shapes the American press to a certain degree into an institution that is transmitting the foreign policy and domestic policy views of the administration in power. There is a natural desire on the part of the press to focus on what's happening in Washington. Even people who write about world affairs are often just gas bags who sit in Washington, never travel abroad, and think that if they have telephoned their sources in the State Department and their sources in the Defense Department, then they have done a complete job of reporting. When I'm reading about foreign news, one thing I always look for is the dateline. I want to know, has the person actually been somewhere? Because the lesson that I have learned in decades as a foreign correspondent, more often than I have learned any other lesson, a lesson I think I've learned 1,000 times. It never ceases to amaze me. Every single time I take a trip to another country, it's this. It's remarkable how much you can learn about a country when you actually go there.
Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, you're listening to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. We've got about 10 minutes or so to go. If folks would like to call in with any questions, there's still a line or two open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. You know, it seems that the stage that the whole debate on Iran takes place on is the stage set by the invasion of Iraq, the claims for weapons of mass destruction there, the claims of ties to al-Qaeda, or the hints that it was connected to 9/11. And that, you know, that what's happened is that people who think that Iraq has been justified and successful are more open to the idea that Iran will be a good idea, and those who think Iraq was wrong are skeptical or cynical toward a prospective Iran invasion. And this gets back to the question about journalists, because I saw a comedian a couple of weeks ago on the Bill Maher program, and he was listening to a Republican tout how great the Iraq war is now going, and I think implying maybe even that Iran should be next on the list. And he said, "Why should I believe you now? You guys have lied to me all the time. I don't believe a word you say." And I think the entire audience erupted. And I think that is how a lot of Americans feel right now. They're very frustrated. Yet our journalism has trouble conveying that honest sentiment.
I do think it's true, as you say, that too much of the debate about Iran, to the extent that there is any, is shaped by the debate about Iraq. I don't think it's necessary to believe that the Iraq war was a great disaster in order to believe that an attack on Iran would be a great disaster. They're separable. Mm-hmm. The Iraq situation is far more advanced. It's in a far different place. We've gotten ourselves into a situation, and now the debate is, what do we do with this situation we're facing? In Iran, we have a different opportunity. We haven't gotten ourselves involved yet in a military way in Iran. Here's, I think, a point that I hope Americans will think about, and I would love people in the White House to reflect on this also. We look at Iran and we see this kind of snarling, anti-Western, pro-religious, anti-Israel regime. And it's also a regime that's involved in a nuclear power program that may also ultimately lead it to try to develop nuclear weapons. So we think to ourselves, what could be worse than that? What we should do is wage an attack that would try to decapitate Iran, get rid of this government, and then wait for the smoke to settle, and whatever comes next, it's got to be something better than this. This is a very dangerous assumption. What could be worse for the United States than the regime we have in Iran right now? It would be no regime. It would be chaos and anarchy in Iran, the kind that we saw after the U.S. Attack on Iraq. That would be even more dangerous than what we had in Iraq, because you'd have dozens of nuclear scientists presumably very angry at the United States for having blown up their houses and killed their friends. And then you would see those scientists perhaps motivated to do something that they haven't done, and there's no sign they would do up to now, and that is put themselves at the service of anti-American terrorists. So the idea that a future regime in Iran would definitely be better than what we have now is a very, very dangerous one.
Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, let's go back to what may well be the most patient caller in the history of Media Matters. Line two, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a, I suppose it's a tangential question, but it has to do with the American imposed sanctions. It appears to me the chief effect is to deprive the Europeans of the access to the natural gas under Iran, the largest reserves in the world. And this allows the Russians to monopolize that market, and they have shown a disposition to use that in a manner that might be called almost blackmail. Would you care to comment on this?
It's certainly true that although the country that has benefited the most from the U.S. Attack on Iraq has been Iran, another country that has greatly benefited from what we've been doing in that part of the world is Russia. Now that we look at the geopolitical situation there, I saw that the Senator Lugar, the chief Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, was just in the caucuses and is now calling for a special American envoy to the caucuses because the caucuses countries are tilting so strongly toward Russia, and Russia's influence is growing there so intensely. This has led us to a situation where we find ourselves pursuing policies that actually help the countries we perceive as our rivals and our enemies. Now, as for sanctions, I happen to have gone to Iraq during the time when Saddam Hussein was in power, so I saw the effect of the sanctions regime there. I visited the hospitals where children were dying by the thousands for lack of medication. But I would go even beyond that. I've watched sanctions in effect in other places, like Yugoslavia, for example. And I see, and I also saw this when I was in Baghdad, that the effect of sanctions is not to deprive a country of what it needs. There's always gangsters and sanction busters who are able to provide that stuff. When Iraq was under sanctions, you could find whole streets that were lined with televisions and refrigerators and car parts brought in through Dubai and other places. And the same thing was happening in Yugoslavia. So what you produce is a criminal class that thrives on sanctions, because when you make something illegal and people want it, naturally the prices will go up and criminals will take advantage of it. So you undermine the legal economy. You throw people into intense poverty and in some cases great suffering, as happened in Iraq, but you actually don't pressure the people that are in power. It's the rich who benefit from sanctions. And those are the ones, the ruling class in those countries, that we theoretically are aiming at with our sanctions. So the world needs to come up with better tools to deal with diplomatic disputes than sanctions, because they often wind up helping the people we're trying to undermine and undermining those pillars of civil society that are in the long run necessary to build a middle class and democracy.
Stephen Kinzer, most Americans, if not all, who follow international politics and U.S. foreign policy rely upon the news media in one form or another to learn about U.S. actions around the world and how foreign governments operate. What media would you recommend to someone who doesn't have, you know, who's working and has a family or commitment, so doesn't have a lot of time, but what media would you recommend to people to stay abreast of what's going on in Iran and get a more accurate picture, if not Iran, also the rest of the world?
There's an interesting website called Iranian.com that sort of accumulates lots of information and material about Iran. I've also lately become a columnist for The Guardian, and The Guardian, although it's a British newspaper, has now great ambitions in the United States. The Guardian America website seeks to become the competitor to the New York Times and Wall Street Journal in providing news about the world for Americans. I always think it's good for Americans to read the press that originates in other countries. You know, when you sit down in front of a TV in England, for example, you'll get TV channels from all over the world. Here in the United States, you never get that. So we have a very U.S.-centric view of the world in our press. The Guardian, because it's published in England, is essentially a paper that comes from a place that's very culturally and politically compatible with the United States and with the way most Americans see the world, but that doesn't have this Washington-centric approach that actually limits so narrowly the way it interprets and views the world.
Stephen Kinzer, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to kick me out of the studio. I want to thank Stephen Kinzer for being our guest today on Media Matters. He will be in Champaign in 2 weeks, February 17th, 3 p.m. at the YMCA. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Andrew O'Boyle and Matt Kessler for engineering the show, Andrew for being the producer. I'll be back in 167 hours.